In 2012, international celebrity South African Paralympian Oscar Pistorius and Reeva Steenkamp appeared together at an awards ceremony. It was the first time that they had been publicly linked. 3 months later, Reeva Steenkamp was dead, shot by Pistorius in his home. He was eventually convicted and is currently in prison. The story, books, movies, has focused on Pistorius and not so much on Reeva, and not so much, says Tim Rowan, on gender-based violence. Tim Rowan is a writer and podcast host with media company Religion of Sports, which with fellow company PRX has launched False Idol, which examines how society's desire to worship heroes can blind it to their flaws. Tim Rowan's with me now. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I just want to start with you giving more profile to Reeva Steenkamp, who, according to you, was pretty much overlooked in the whole storm of publicity about Oscar Pistorius. She was portrayed as a glamorous model and Oscar's girlfriend. Who was she?
Through the course of reporting out the podcast, I had the chance to talk to Kim Martin, who was Reeva's cousin, who was older than Reeva, but really spent a lot of time with her when she was young. And also, obviously, they were close as adults as well. And Kim walked us through Reeva's whole life, from her time growing up in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, riding horses. Kim described her as a strong, confident country girl. And her father was a horse trainer, Reeva's. And Reeva went on and she started modeling as a teenager, but she took her schooling seriously. She went on and studied law at university. And then, she went on and kind of shifted gears and went on to become a model. And she had a very successful modeling career. She did commercials, photo shoots. She had just been cast in a reality show in South Africa, and her career was really on the rise. And not only that, as her star was growing, Reeva really found her voice. In law school, she had done her thesis on South African marriage law. So she seemed to be really interested in interpersonal relationships, how we interact with one another. And so when she became a celebrity in South Africa and she was booked on this reality show and her name was getting more and more out there, she started to speak out about issues she cared about. And talking to Kim, and from what I know about Reeva, she was really passionate about gender-based violence and speaking out against the abuse of women and children. And, she would participate in these social media campaigns. And, she was just starting to do that when she met Oscar Pistorius. Like you said, they made their first appearance together in November 2012. And then just 3 months later, he killed her. And one of the parts of this tragedy that I think people forget is, like I said, she was just coming to her own and finding her voice. And shortly before Reeva died, there was another very tragic murder of a young woman in South Africa. Her name was Anine Boysen. And Reeva had spoken out about that. And then less than 2 weeks later, Reeva lost her own life. But on Valentine's Day 2013, Reeva was supposed to give a speech to a group of high school students. And she was going to talk about gender-based violence and about relationships and speak to young girls about these important issues. And, part of the tragedy is she never got to give that speech because Pistorius took her life, shortly before that.
You are in no doubt that Oscar Pistorius committed violence against Reeva, and yet an extraordinarily large number of people still argue that he was anxiety riddled and emotionally deficient and reacted to what he thought was an intruder. What's your view?
Yeah, I think, again, the reporter in me, I'm going to kind of interview people and lay it out there. But yeah, that was interesting to kind of explore that why people would have that opinion. And I think it goes to the history of South Africa, right? And the complicated, the violent history of apartheid and then the rise in home break-ins around the time that Oscar Pistorius is growing up. On the witness stand, he described these incidences where he claimed that, his mother's house had been broken into, when he was young. And so he was trying to paint himself as kind of a victim of, he was trying to paint himself as very fearful, as a victim, as someone who was afraid and constantly afraid of someone breaking into his home. And, you know, I talked to a lot of experts, people who are from South Africa who, you know, have studied this and who have lived there and know the culture and the climate a lot better than I do. And what they said was, you know, Pistorius, whether it was conscious or not, was speaking to this, you know, the environment in South Africa, right? The context in which he was raised. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot of people that didn't believe it, that thought he was, you know, using the excuse of the intruder to cover up what really happened and maybe something more sinister. So yeah, a lot of people I spoke for the podcast were of that opinion.
I mean, South Africa has a reputation for having an extraordinarily high crime rate and a violent crime rate. So that would be enough to make anybody who was a celebrity such as Oscar Pistorius nervous. You clearly don't believe that he was anxious enough to shoot blindly into the bathroom.
Well, I think, again, you know, I think what you know, the people I talked to for the podcast, I spoke to Andrea Johnson, who is the prosecutor on the case against Pistorius. And her point was, you know, he fired 4 shots through the bathroom door. And so, again, whether or not you believe Pistorius's story, whether he knew Riva was behind that door or whether he thought there was an intruder behind that door, he fired 4 times through the door. And so, you know, obviously that says something, right? That, you know, what did he think would happen if he fired 4 shots through a bathroom door? So, yeah, I mean, that's a violent act in and of itself, right?
The podcast that you have made covers a lot of aspects of Pistorius's life, as well as Reva's, of course, and includes the tortuous way that the case went through various courts. I mean, that's extraordinary. We probably haven't even got time to go through all that. Suffice it to say, he's in jail now. He's due out 2023, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, well, his parole. Yeah, he's eligible for parole in 2023, yeah.
All right. The description of his career is really fascinating. And you describe how in the early 2000s, Paralympics was dominated by a couple of US sprinters, and Pistorius just came and wiped them out, despite the fact that they were both, you know, really well ahead, and they were on the world's, you know, fastest amputees. Pistorius used these blades about which there were a lot of questions asked. What were the questions?
Yeah, no, and exactly right. We started a series with Marlon Shirley and Brian Frazier, who were the stars of the Paralympics in the early 2000s, two U.S. sprinters. And you're right, in our first episode, they raise a lot of questions about Pistorius's blades. And the questions kind of followed Pistorius throughout his career. And I think they were kind of overshadowed because on the surface, everyone's like, this guy's winning a lot of gold medals. He's bringing a lot of pride to South Africa. A lot of people saw him as an inspirational figure. But talking to Marlon Shirley and Brian Frazier, they felt like, you know, maybe some of their races weren't always fair, especially Marlon Shirley. And, you know, we get into the details, but essentially Marlon Shirley and Brian Frazier are unilateral amputees. They only have one of their legs that is amputated, whereas Oscar Pistorius is a bilateral amputee and both of his lower legs are amputated. And so, you know, you can imagine that there's different biomechanics that are going on when those two athletes are running against each other. And so, you know, Marlon kind of walked us through the ways in which Pistorius had an advantage over him in their races. And so as Pistorius is building a name for himself and winning all these medals and becoming a world-class athlete, you know, Marlon Shirley is kind of looking there saying, well, you know, does he really deserve to be winning all these races, right? And so he raised those questions. And then later on, when Oscar obviously ran at the 2012 London Olympics, and I think obviously that was his crowning achievement as an athlete and probably the sporting moment that people most, you know, recognize for him, there was a lot of questions leading up to those games about whether Oscar's blades gave him an advantage in races against able-bodied athletes. And I interviewed two researchers, Dr. Peter Weyen and Dr. Matthew Bundle, who studied Pistorius. They had him in their lab in the United States, and they put him through a series of tests. And at the end of the tests, they concluded that, yes, his blades gave him an advantage. And so, you know, but just the way it worked out, they're kind of, even though they voiced those concerns, they fell on deaf ears. And Pistorius was able to run at the Olympics despite all these questions about his blades.
It seems so strange, doesn't it, that a double amputee should have an advantage over a single amputee, and furthermore, an advantage over an able-bodied athlete.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, the simplest way I could put it for the able-bodied athlete conversation is Dr. Wayan and Dr. Bundle put Pistorius through these tests, and what they found was that Pistorius's swing times were off the charts. And the simplest way to explain that, the swing time is the measurement of, you know, if you're running, say, you know, you're a jogger at home, and you know, it's the amount of time it takes for your right foot to touch the ground, and then you pick it up, and for your right foot to touch the ground again, and that's your swing time. And what they measured was Pistorius's swing times were just off the charts. They were really fast. And what they attributed that to was the blades, because Oscar's blades were lighter than the lower part of the human leg, which allowed him to swing his legs faster. And so, you know, they have all these calculations and they've spent years researching this. And so when they punched in the numbers, they found that he would be, you know, several seconds faster in the 400 meters due to the blades. And so, we kind of talk about in the podcast how that goes against maybe, you know, common sense, but these are two researchers who studied Pistorius up front, who've been, you know, in this field for a long time, and they, you know, came to the conclusion that he had an advantage.
It sounds like sour grapes. You know, it's quite bold of Marlon Shirley and Brian Fraser to speak out, because it sounds like they're complaining about being beaten.
Yeah, you know, I think you could look at it that way, but you know, I don't think I didn't get that sense. I mean, you know, again, I don't think people even recognize this at the time, and it's kind of a tricky thing, right? And we talk about this. The reason that they were running against each other is because there weren't enough bilateral amputees to run their own race. So there weren't enough double amputees like Pistorius to run their own race at the Paralympics. Excuse me. And so they had to run together. So it was kind of just the circumstance they found themselves in. But I certainly found it interesting.
I was very interested by the mention in your podcast. At one point, something really unexpected came up, and you discovered that Marlon Shirley, one of the U.S. sprinters who had dominated the Paralympics until the arrival of Oscar Pistorius, and you're talking about gender violence. Shirley had assaulted his girlfriend in 2000. And you had to go there, right? Because you can't ignore something like that in a podcast of this texture. So what happened?
Yeah, you kind of explained it. Yeah, when doing the research for the podcast, I saw that Marlon Shirley was basically Oscar Pistorius's main rival. You know, like we've been talking about here, Marlon Shirley was arguably the face of the Paralympics in the early 2000s. And then Oscar Pistorius came along and kind of knocked him off that pedestal. And so we spent hours, you know, I interviewed Marlon for several hours, and, you know, he's one of the main characters in the first episode. And we were, you know, in the process of putting the episode together and in doing more research on Marlon. And we found that incident that you referred to, that in the year 2000, Marlon was involved in a gender-based violence incident with his former girlfriend. And so when we discovered that, exactly, you know, we felt like we needed to address it on the podcast, given that we were going to be spending episodes talking about Oscar Pistorius' behavior off the track and his own, you know, instances in which he was abusive towards partners in his life, and talking about gender-based violence. And so then, once I found that out, you know, I reached out to Marlon and we did an interview. And so you hear that conversation at the end of the first episode of, you know, me talking to Marlon about this incident from 2000. And I think a point that I do make there in the podcast is that, you know, what's interesting is, you know, this happened, Marlon's gender-based violence incident happened in the year 2000. And it happened like a few months or a short time before the 2000 Paralympics. And that was the first Paralympics when Marlon Shirley kind of became a star, and he won medals, and, you know, he made a trip to the White House. And, you know, shortly after that, Marlon becomes a star and there's all these glowing profiles and he's traveling and making appearances. And no one mentions the incident with his ex-girlfriend that happened in early 2000. And so, you know, in all the research that we had done on Marlon, no one had ever mentioned this incident. And then, you know, we found it and felt like we had to talk to him about it.
Let's talk about, and it's another thing that you mentioned in your podcast, of course, the need for South Africa at that point in the early 2000s for a good story, for an uplifting story. Tell me about that in the context of the country.
Yeah, no, yeah. We, and again, going back to the title of the podcast is False Idol, right? And so in the early part of the podcast, we talk about how we collectively as a society, people of South Africa and beyond, idolize Oscar Pistorius and how he became this celebrated figure. And, you know, in talking to people, it became clear, you know, talking to South Africans and people who watched Pistorius's career and were closely observing it, that he arrived at kind of the perfect time. You know, Oscar came onto the scene in 2004, and that was the year of his first Paralympics. And he comes onto the scene and he immediately is this incredible Paralympic sprinter. And like you said, it was, you know, that's about 10 years after the end of apartheid, and South Africa is still recovering from this very violent, you know, very intense time in the country. And they're looking for a hero. They're looking for a good story. They're looking for something to root for. And I talked to people as South Africans who said, you know, that they saw themselves reflected in him. And here was this South African on the world stage performing at a high level and bringing a lot of pride, you know, to the country.
So consequently, a lot of his bad behavior, and he had behaved badly on a number of occasions, was not looked into. You say there's no culture of investigative sports journalism in South Africa, which is not unusual, of course, because sport is sport. But this was a serious omission, and he was allowed to get away with it. And thus we come to the fate of Reeva Steenkamp. But even if people had focused on his bad behavior, his passion for speeding, his hair trigger temper, what could have been done?
That's a great question. Yeah, and that's a tricky one to answer. You can't go back and change anything, right? But I do think if we, you know, pay closer attention, you know, you mentioned there that there's no, maybe it's normal not to have investigative journalists looking into sports heroes. But I would argue that that's exactly the type of people we should, you know, who should be scrutinized and under a microscope, and their behavior being held to a high standard, because some of these people are held up as role models. But, you know, going back to that behavior, you know, some of it was public and some of it wasn't. And we're talking about Oscar Pistorius's bad behavior. You know, another person I interviewed Trish Taylor, who is the mother of Samantha Taylor, who is one of Pistorius's ex-girlfriends. And Trish was describing, you know, you mentioned it there, how Pistorius liked to speed, but she also had some really disturbing things to say just about how Pistorius was emotionally and verbally abusive towards her daughter throughout the relationship, how he would shout at her, times in which she was afraid of him. There's one instance where she was so afraid of him, she felt like she had to hide his gun. And so, you know, to answer your question, it's hard to go back and say what would have been different. But I think if, just generally speaking, if we were to scrutinize, you know, people like Oscar Pistorius, who are held to high esteem, who are behaving badly, you know, it's obviously better to do that, and maybe you can catch something.
It's hard for us, perhaps, to understand the celebrity attached to Oscar Pistorius. I mean, he was huge, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I mean, he was on ads for Nike. I think people around the world knew him. He certainly broke through into mainstream media, you know, not just in sports, but beyond that. I mean, he was held up as a hero of South Africa, an inspirational figure.
Do you find yourself having sympathy for him? He did a terrible thing, but he is a guy, he's a double amputee. His mother died when he was young. He's suddenly extraordinarily famous, and he's having to deal with it without necessarily having the emotional wherewithal to do so. Do you have sympathy for him?
Yeah, again, to answer your question, I lean on kind of the people that I interviewed and their opinions. But sympathy is an interesting, idea. And, we kind of get into that later on in some episodes that haven't been released. But yeah, I mean, look, we give all that context throughout the podcast. And I think it's a complicated story. He is a complicated person. You went through it, his rise, his fall, his backstory with his mother and, his life, but then also, I don't know if that excuses the bad behavior though. Right. And, how he was verbally and emotionally abusive, towards Samantha Taylor, how he was treated, Reva Steenkamp, and how, they got into arguments shortly before he killed her. It's a complicated story. He's a complicated person, and we get into all that in the podcast.
Yeah, and there's a link to the podcast on our webpage. Just finally, Tim, what do you think is going to happen to him when he gets out of jail?
That's a great question. And I asked Andrea Johnson, the prosecutor, I asked her, about his parole date, which is coming up in 2023. And, what she said, and, this is going to come in our final episode. And what she said was, what stuck with me, she said, I hope he's humbled himself. That's what she said. She said, I hope he's humbled himself. She thought he was, very cocky or whatever word you would use. And also, she hopes that, he can find a way to reintegrate himself in society. And, she had a lot more to say than that. But, we get into that in the final episode. But it'll certainly be interesting to see. So that parole date's coming up 2023. So that's the next date to watch.
Well, I mean, he'll only be able to get parole if he shows himself to be humble, will he not?
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
It's a fascinating series. Thank you, fascinating podcast. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Tim Rowan, who is a journalist with Religion of Sports, and they have made this podcast called False Idol, which is about Oscar Pistorius, fascinating story.